Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news. Grassroots news coverage from coast to coast to coast. Groundwire is brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit by the Groundwire National Coordination Team. I'm your host, Matt Willish. In this episode...
We are here today rallying against the Red Cross because of the way our evacuees are being treated.
Those caribou are tribal members who are completely at risk.
My name is Mohammed. I came from Sierra Leone. Radio camp is where people listen to radio.
But first, here are the headlines. On Monday, September 14th, Grassy Narrows First Nations filed legal proceedings against Ontario, asking the Divisional Court to halt the province's plans to clear-cut their territory. The lawsuit alleges that the logging will prolong the harms caused by mercury poisoning in their community, and that it violates their charter rights to security and freedom from discrimination. Gunargi O'Sullivan from Co-op Radio Vancouver spoke with Deputy Chief of Grassy Narrows, Randy Forbister.
Randy Forbister, who is a deputy chief of Grassy Narrows. Last time we spoke to him, we talked about the threat of mercury on the people. And now Grassy Narrows sues Ontario over a mercury health threat from clear-cut logging.
And the one we're challenging is, the natural mercury from industry, smokestacks or whatever that carries into the land.
Uh-huh.
And there's science that shows, that natural mercury, and when there's clear cuts and it releases mercury into our waters, into our river, also into lakes that have never been, contaminated by a dried mill. So, but this adds our concern, it adds on to the English River.
Yeah, that the people of your community fear that the clear-cut logging will release mercury into the local waterways, further poisoning local fish and people who already live in the area, the bears, and the burden of the mercury that was dumped into the river by a paper mill in the 60s continues to have its effect on your people, right?
Yes, that's the concern, and today a lot of our people are still sick.
Mm-hmm.
And we recently had a state of emergency regarding our tap water. We're still challenging, under the charter rights, where it directly affects the way we live, the mercury and the health. And that's the charter rights is the top law.
Yes. The interesting thing about the actions that you're taking is that this will become the first case to successfully use the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms to protect people against harm and discrimination. We mentioned that. But you say that it saddens you that they are faced to fight in court to protect the children from dangerous mercury impacts of clear-cut logging. And also that you hope that the court will finally end Ontario's long legacy of forcing harm decisions on your families and on your homeland.
If successful, the lawsuit could have a huge impact on the Indigenous communities across Canada. This is the first time resource extraction has been challenged on the basis of the Charter of Rights to Security and Freedom from Discrimination due to environmental degradation. Thank you to Gunargi O'Sullivan for the audio used in that report.
Earlier this month, QP 3902 Women's Caucus, the union representing teaching assistants at the University of Toronto, organized a rally in response to online threats made against women at the university. Ellie Edeker is an executive member of QP 3902 and a PhD student in sociology.
The threats were concerning these comments that were made online that were targeting women and feminists, but specifically women and feminists in sociology and women in gender studies at U of T, encouraging people on campus to commit like extreme acts of violence against us.
Though these threats were vile and targeted, they are contextualized within a continued silence about gendered and sexual violence on U of T campus. and indeed on campuses around the country.
With these particular threats, the issue is that we didn't find out about them through the university, or at least how specific they were through the university. We found out about that through QP 3902 and through our union. And so I think that that's a symptom of a larger issue in that we're not having real conversations about gendered violence, about sexual violence at U of T. Those are sort of the conversations we like to sweep under the rug or not address head on. And so, unfortunately, it took this, like, these horrific comments to kind of drive people to at least drive the administration to care about it after we pressured them and after we brought thousands of people out on campus.
The rally called upon the university to address issues of violence against women on campus and to a larger context of misogyny and sexism that continues to persist.
We were calling for a broader conversation around misogyny on campus and what that looks like. We were calling for community-based solutions because right now the way the administration is responding is by giving us the option to have police officers in our classes, and that's not something that makes everyone feel safe. That's not something that tackles the root of the issue. Like, the answer isn't, like, securitization. The answer isn't more police officers on campus. The answer should be something that builds community and that sort of, like, builds connections between undergraduate students and faculty, grad students, and admin staff on campus. We need to be having the conversation collectively. And I think the point of the rally was to really show that at this point, between us and the university, we haven't been having that conversation collectively. It's been very one-sided, and we've been hearing the information they want us to hear and not the information we need to kind of move forward together.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. Heard Pow Wow Wow by Chris Dirksen. Now it's time for our feature stories. With the refugee crisis in the news and impacting the federal election campaign, there is suspiciously little attention being paid to the hundreds of First Nations members in Manitoba's Interlake region who were forced to abandon their homeland during the flood of 2011 and complain of ongoing strife, hardship, harassment, and even death 4 years later. Michael Welch from the University of Winnipeg-based CKUW had a chance to meet some of these affected individuals, and today he brings us their story.
In the spring of 2011, Manitoba was devastated by major flooding. Water was diverted from the swollen Assiniboine River northward to Lake Manitoba and then toward Lake St. Martin, forcing the evacuation of residents from four First Nations communities. In effect, these communities were sacrificed to protect the city of Winnipeg and other southern communities along the Assiniboine from flooding. The vast majority of these evacuees were relocated to Winnipeg to be housed in hotels and other temporary shelters. What no one realized at the time was that these evacuees would still be away from their territories 4 years later. Forced removal to this strange urban landscape is taking its toll, but more than that, many of these dislocated people are complaining that the authorities tasked with their welfare are subjecting them to unjust treatment, resulting in homelessness, despair, and even death. September 9, 2015, a group of about a dozen Anishinaabe people held a peaceful protest outside the Red Cross offices on Portage Avenue in Winnipeg. I approached one of the participants to find out what the focus of their protest was.
My name is Bertha Travers. I'm from Little Saskatchewan First Nation. And we are here today rallying against the Red Cross because of the way our evacuees are being treated. They took over last year. Prior to that, we were being looked after by the Manitoba Association of Native Firefighters. They were actually funded through Aboriginal Affairs and also through Emergency Response of Manitoba. But they were corrupt, and the services were eventually taken away from them, from looking after the evacuees because of the corruption. And then Red Cross took over. Now what Red Cross is doing to us is sending people, ex-manif staff, sending them over to evacuees' homes and trying to check their beds and their clothing to see if they actually live in those homes. They've been threatened that if they don't let them in or, you know, comply to their request to come inside, they've been threatened with the cutoff of their evacuee funds. We've had deaths happening, and we've also had suicides. If you rounded off the numbers, it'd probably be close to about 100 people. And then when our evacuees are taken off the evacuee list, they are no longer eligible to get funding for their apartments or room and board anywhere. And they become homeless on top of being homeless. You know, how much more can people take?
I approached the Red Cross to address the allegation from the evacuees from Little Saskatchewan. They were not available for comment, but did send the following emailed response. Quote, "At the Red Cross, we understand that there may be flood evacuees who find it difficult and stressful to live away from their home communities. We have been in contact with the individuals and have listened to their concerns. We always appreciate hearing people's suggestions and will work together to find the best solutions for all involved." Unquote. I managed to catch up with the provincial premier, Greg Selinger, to get his thoughts about the situation affecting the Little Saskatchewan and other First Nations evacuees.
It's been way too long for people to get back home. It has been a source of frustration for the members of the community, certainly a source of frustration for us. We're working to ensure that we rebuild those communities in partnership with their leadership on higher ground, safer communities with better protection so they don't flood again. We don't want to see them flooded out every 3, 4, 5 years. We want to rebuild those communities so they can be safe from floods in the future.
And right now, in terms of what...
We are actively engaged with them on solutions to rebuilding their communities, including making more land available, including building proper diking in those areas to make sure those communities are safe.
Have you met... I mean, when you say you've met with them, are you talking about their leadership? Have you met with the individuals?
We have a working group in Manitoba. We've hired a special person who works directly with the First Nations to resolve all their issues, liaises between the First Nations and the federal government. We have a full-time person on contract working on these solutions.
We as evacuees are the ones that are looking after our own evacuees because, you know, the government, the Indian Affairs, Aboriginal Affairs, and Red Cross have chosen to cut people off their funding.
From downtown Winnipeg, an occupied Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota, this has been CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
That was brought to us by Michael Welch of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, on Treaty 1 territory. Voices you heard in that report included Bertha Travers and Manitoba Premier Greg Selinger. We now hear a message from immigration detainees 2 years after their historic hunger strike, highlighting the continued need to resist and fight against the unfounded detention of refugees and permanent residences by the Canadian Border Services Agency.
Correctional Center. I'm on immigration. I'm going on 3 years right now. And right now, it's been 2 years since we did the hunger strike. Right now, for everybody, nothing has changed. Everything is the same. I'm a Somalian nationality, and it's not issuing me no China document. Canada's using their own China document to take me back to my country, which is not right. We here, and we're trying to stay strong. And why not, you know, we're away from our family and our friends and our loved ones. And hopefully sometime we could be with them.
There's a lot of refugees are here for no reason. A lot of people are landed and they took away our land and our permanent residence. I don't know what permanent means. I thought permanent means you're supposed to be a permanent resident of a country. There's a lot of people here suffering. A lot of good people too. A guy died in here because of a sickness just because the CBS didn't want to release him. I don't know what to say, but personally, for me, I've been in the country for 40 years, and I think it's wrong what they're doing. I don't understand this. It's like you get one criminal, you have a criminal record, and it's just like, okay, you're in danger, so you have to go back. But it's like the crime that they have to commit is like non-violent or nothing towards other people. It's crazy because it's like, how are you going to send back somebody who's a refugee that has been here all their life and then they commit a crime and they've been good for so long and you want to send them back? It's like there's no mercy. And when you're sitting here and you're trying to show them rehabilitation, it's hard because there's no program. Families are really suffering the most out of all of this. It's not the moms, girlfriends, husbands, wives, everybody's suffering because of the situation here. So the people should get together and protest a little bit more. The law needs to change. The law needs to change. There's people out there could put pressure on CBSA and that they could try to fix their system because it's getting out of hand with these super long detention. It's like people that wait on first-degree charges are getting out before people that are on immigration, which doesn't even make sense.
Thank you guys for keeping up the good fight for us, and we do appreciate it. Thank you.
That piece was produced by Mina Ramos at CFRU in Guelph, Ontario. Our final feature comes from southern British Columbia. The Valhalla Wilderness Society is calling for an independent review of two penning projects for the endangered mountain caribou after a number of calves died this year.
Those caribou are tribal members who are completely at risk.
That was Marilyn James, matriarch of Sinaiks Nation in southeastern BC, referring to the mountain caribou, possibly the most endangered large mammal in North America. A recent count found only 1,600 remaining, down from the approximately 2,500 animals counted in 1995. And from the herds of many thousands believed to have existed at one time. Mountain caribou feed mostly on lichen and rely entirely on old-growth forest habitat found in the world's only inland temperate rainforest in the Columbia Mountains of British Columbia and northern Washington and Idaho in the U.S. Caribou herds are in decline in the region as a result of widespread changes in the old-growth forest habitat from logging and resource extraction, road building, recreational use of snowmobiles, and other development. The science is clear that the habitat fragmentation of old forests have made mountain caribou more vulnerable to predation from wolves. One of the controversial strategies being used to shore up the dwindling mountain caribou population is a multi-year wolf kill in the BC interior. Another controversial tactic is maternity penning, also known as captive rearing. Maternity penning involves keeping newborn calves with their mothers in a large pen for the first few weeks of their lives. The hope is that, once the calves are a few months old, they'll have grown big enough to more effectively outrun predators. However, many, like Marilyn James, are skeptical about the value of maternity penning as a preservation strategy for mountain caribou. Recently, in a small herd of 18, one adult cow and four newborn calves died in a pen near Revelstoke, and in a similar project near Chetwynd, one calf was stillborn and one died of unknown causes. Craig Pettit, a director with the Valhalla Wilderness Society, questions if the survival rate in the maternity pens was really any better than in the wild. He says a 2004 independent scientific panel advised against maternity penning for Revelstoke, saying it would be, quote, intrusive, costly, and high risk, unquote. The Wilderness Society takes the position that maternity penning may add to the stress that caribou are already experiencing in the wild as a result of widespread habitat destruction, and that stress in pregnant caribou may affect the birth and survival of calves. In order to get them into the maternity pens, pregnant caribou are chased with helicopters and netted, tranquilized, transported within the net by helicopter, and then sledded into a pen where they are held for several months. In the wild, caribou near Revelstoke originally gave birth at high elevation where there was still up to a meter of snow. They did so in isolation from other caribou, which minimized the risk of predation. But the pen used by the Revelstoke Caribou Rearing in the Wild project is located in a valley bottom, and this year the caribou were subjected to one of BC's worst heat waves ever. At one point after the calves were born, there were 34 caribou from several local herds in the pen. The caribou were reportedly frequently spooked, resulting in the injury and subsequent death of one calf after being trampled by the other caribou. Given the caribou's poor condition in general, wildlife veterinarians ordered that they be released earlier than planned. Another concern about the penning project is greenwashing. Logging companies and multinational energy corporations have jumped on the maternity penning bandwagon as a way to justify continued development or resource extraction in caribou habitat. Resource extractors and winter recreators create the predator problem and then they throw money at it. The Valhalla Wilderness Society believes that an unbiased and independent review, not connected with these commercial projects, is necessary to look into the declining populations and decide if maternity penning is better than allowing the young caribou to fend for themselves. Craig Pettit asks, quote, how can the public be sure that decisions are being made in the interests of the caribou and not on behalf of economic interests wanting to avoid further habitat protection? Unquote. This is Catherine Fisher in Sinek's Territory, reporting for Groundware. Music included in the feature was by Matthew Lean and the Caribou Commons Project.
Now it's time for our community radio report, brought to us by Victoria King, telling us about CKUW's Kids Radio Camp in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
It has been scientifically proven that boxing bass players are proven to be the coolest. Yelling, "Pop the clutch, Timmy, pop the clutch," makes car crashes 10 times more awesome. Condensed awesome sauce has been proven to have medicinal properties. And the number 145 is unlucky, especially when combined with a man named Jerry in a white van sitting in an orange chair with a red Jordan's cap.
It may not be your typical newscast, but everybody's got to start somewhere. This past August, for 3 weeks, CKUW hosted Radio Camp. Now in its 9th year, Radio Camp offers kids from downtown Winnipeg the opportunity to get behind the mic, learn about radio, and have some fun.
I'm Jay Vanaventer, and I am the director of CKUW's Radio Camp. Radio Camp is an inner-city program set up through the University of Winnipeg's radio stations, CKUW 95.9 FM. The basis of the camp is we have a group of kids every week We get them on Monday, and then by Friday, they have a one-hour radio show that's all them. There's very little adults in there other than them interviewing adults, but it's 100% the kids doing their own radio show. You know, we teach them the ins and outs of radio, how to do radio production. A big focus I do, too, is teaching kids interview skills.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about our favorite chip. This is our last segment. So, Marley, what's your favorite chip?
I would have to say salt and vinegar. I'm sorry, Dorito fans.
I don't have a favorite chip. What about you, Gracie?
I honestly like any type of Pringles chips.
Annie?
I like Ruffles and barbecue chips.
Kirsten?
I like sour cream Pringles.
Up next we have... We're going to talk about more into pop culture, such as video games and cartoons. Cartoons are quite popular and have been around for some quite time. And so, Herman, you got any favorite cartoons, bruh?
Well, when I was small, I used to watch Ben 10 and Tom and Jerry.
Like,
yeah, that's
classic stuff.
Yeah, all the classics. Yeah, they were pretty funny for me in those days.
In each session, we strive to have about 12, so I would say 10 to 12 kids every week. Campers come mostly from the inner city of Winnipeg, so lots of kids from the West End and really central Winnipeg. Radio Camp is a big part of the community because we do a lot of things with Art City and Studio 393, which are both community inner city programs, and even the Bike Lab with the University of Winnipeg. We try to make the show very community-based. The Radio Camp live show is it's pretty chaotic, but in a good way. It really depends on the kids, too. So sometimes it is a little bit more focused. It depends on the group of kids, but then sometimes it's just like the stuff that they produce is so random but hilarious. It really... makes for some interesting, good radio.
I would be talking to you guys about fashion, back-to-school outfits that you could wear, and, like, what's in season for fall. It's mainly plaid and crop tops.
So. Hey, guys, I'm Alfie, and the weather's going to be in New York 5,000, 3 million, and 3 million fire tornadoes. So get out of the city now.
Well, it's interesting because we do have a very diverse group of kids every week. Radio Camp does a lot of work with NEEDS and ERCOM, which have new immigrants coming into Canada, specifically Winnipeg, of course. But I would say what's really interesting about those kind of shows, when we have a very heavy immigrant population for the week, it introduces people to their culture. And it introduces them to songs that are popular. And they will even do reviews on movies sometimes from their own country. I don't think it just benefits them. I think it also benefits the listeners and even the adults working in the program.
My name is Mohammed. I came from Australia. Radio Camp is where people listen to radio. I like sport, basketball, skating. Who is my favorite soccer player? Kaka. He play for Mali.
I love working with kids, and I would say, too, that it is a great program for the kids in the summer. It really does, I think, help build self-esteem in children, which is a really important skill to have.
This was Victoria King and Radio Camp 2015 from CKUW in Winnipeg, reporting for Groundwire.
This is the group of Radio Camp.
Bye.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the Groundwire National Coordination Team. Music this week was by Chris Dirksen. Headlines this week, written by Ome Salma Rabintula with Ellie Attiker and Carly Forbes, featuring files from Gennardi O'Sullivan. We would also like to thank Matt Willish and Yasmin Rabintula for voicing. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Additionally, you can listen as a podcast on the Rabble Radio Podcast Network. Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.